This is Science Friday. I'm Sci-Fi producer Kathleen Davis. Later in the show, it's been 50 years since scientists discovered one of our oldest relatives, the famous hominin Lucy. Plus, Asheville, North Carolina just restored clean drinking water 53 days after Hurricane Helene. We'll take a look at the science of water purification and why it can take so long after a major storm. But first, on Tuesday, rocket company SpaceX conducted another test flight of its Starship spacecraft. The rocket did launch successfully, but the company decided not to try some landing acrobatics. Joining me to talk about that and other stories from this week in science is Sci-Fi's own Charles Berquist. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Kathleen.
So tell me more about this launch.
Yeah, so this was the sixth test flight of SpaceX's Starship craft. This was uncrewed, so no people aboard, and it lasted about an hour. And the big question that they were looking at here was whether or not they could restart the engines while in orbit, which obviously is something you'd need to be able to do to make big course and orbit changes. And it turned out that engine restart worked.
So they didn't hit all of their goals for launch, though, right?
Yeah, so I mean, this was kind of a stretch goal, you might say. You might have seen back in October this maneuver where the booster stage, the super heavy booster, returned to the launch tower and was caught upright, almost like a pair of giant chopsticks clamping onto the sides of it. A repeat of that move was on the table for this launch, but at the last minute, they made a choice not to do that and instead let the booster splash down into the ocean.
Okay, I see. So it's my understanding you have a related story about Starship. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I mean, this Starship super heavy booster combination is big, really big. And launching that takes a lot of rocket power. This thing has 33 engines.
Wow.
If you've ever been near even a normal rocket launch, you know that they're loud. So researchers asked, just how loud is a Starship launch? And it turns out a team from BYU placed a bunch of sensors around the area to monitor some previous launch attempts.
Okay, so what did they find?
Well, big secret here. It's really, really loud. I mean, not so much a sound as like a force. Even 10 kilometers away, we're talking rock concert levels of sound here. And at 20 kilometers, think table saw, snowblower, something like that. And 30 to 35 kilometers away, you're still looking at sound levels like a vacuum cleaner or a hairdryer.
Wow. I mean, this might be a silly question, but aren't all rockets really loud?
Yeah, I mean, sure, it's a rocket. Of course it's loud, but this is really louder than many other launches. SpaceX has a smaller launch vehicle that they use a lot called Falcon. This Starship Super Heavy combination launch was the equivalent of 10 Falcon rocket launches.
Wow.
And the estimates are that the noise is equivalent to around 5 launches of the Space Launch System. That's the launch vehicle under development for part of NASA's Artemis program.
I mean, does that level of noise affect anything?
Yeah, I mean, it could, right? This is the kind of sound pressure that can actually start to cause cracks in walls or windows. After the October test launch, there were some reports of property damage in the town nearby the launch site. Those haven't been really officially tabulated. But there's also the question of whether this might be harmful to wildlife nearby, especially as the frequency of these launches ramps up and they use it more.
Mm-hmm. So something to keep an eye on as this goes forward. Let's stay in space for our next story. There's something more distant in the news.
Yeah, this is a story coming out of the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope Interferometer project. They were able to take a zoomed-in, close-up image of a star called WOHG64. What's significant here is this is a star 160,000 light years away.
Wow.
It's not even in our own Milky Way galaxy. It's in another galaxy called the Large Magellanic Cloud.
Okay, so we were able to get this close-up image. What did it look like?
Yeah, you see this kind of glowing egg-shaped ring surrounding a kind of fuzzy thing. And astronomers think that what they're seeing is gas being driven off from the star. It's shedding all this gas rapidly as it moves through the last stages of its life. And some of the astronomers think that this star is dying and could someday become a supernova.
Huh. Okay, so how were they able to even get this image?
Yeah, I mean, one factor here is just advances in telescope technology. this instrument is actually four big telescopes in Chile that can combine together into one interferometer instrument to see extra small things. But, I mean, it's not really cheating, but this star is a red supergiant and is something like 2,000 times the size of our sun. So you're not seeing our sun in a distant galaxy, but this is still a super impressive result.
So, yeah, this is a very large object, to put it mildly.
Yes, very large.
Okay, so back here on Earth for our next story, there are advances in dealing with the chemicals known as PFAS chemicals or forever chemicals. Tell me about this, Charles.
Right, so these are a group of chemicals called perfluoro and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Basically, that means that they have a lot of carbon-fluorine bonds in them, and those bonds are really strong chemically. On the one hand, that's part of what makes these chemicals useful for a lot of things like flame retardants, stain repellents, nonstick coatings. But it also means that they're very hard to break down. And that's what these two papers in Nature this week are discovering. The researchers found that by using catalysts that were activated by light, they were able to break that tough bond at pretty mild temperatures. Normally, these bonds take a lot of energy to break, and that's usually in the form of heat. You got to really crank up the heat to get this bond to break. But the light-activated catalysts were able to get over that energy hurdle a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, PFAS chemicals are a big problem. They're on a lot of people's minds. Is this a possible solution?
So this is a start. Neither of these catalyst systems is really ready for prime time yet. Importantly, one of the big troubles, as you know, with the PFAS chemicals right now is when they get into people's water supply.
Mm-hmm.
But these particular catalysts don't work all that well in water. So there are some challenges to be worked out here to make this really useful.
All right. So maybe a piece of the puzzle, but we still need a lot more solutions. So turning from light to sound. There is a study this week about how whales hear. Tell me about this, Charles.
Yeah. So this is published this week in Science. And I don't know about you, but I usually think of whale noises as mainly being low frequency sounds with those incredible songs that they do, right? But in this research, the scientists were actually able to give two minke whales a hearing test, and they found that they can hear at higher frequencies than they previously thought.
Charles, I got to ask, how do you give a whale a hearing test?
So I don't know if you ever had to do this in like elementary school. You strap the big clunky headphones on the head and you raise the flipper when you hear the beep on each side. No, this is not what they did. First, they had to safely catch the whales. They found a natural channel that ran in between two islands in Norway. The migrating whales tended to swim through. And in this area, they set up a system of net barriers to temporarily restrain two adolescent minke whales. Then they put electrodes on the surface of their skin in the place of those big clunky headphones. So this is a non-invasive procedure. And they played sounds at the whales and watched the electrical activity. And they found that the minkes could detect frequencies as high as 45 to 90 kilohertz, which it's much higher than they previously thought just looking at the ear structures and listening to the sounds that they usually make when they're singing.
All right. Well, I understand you have some other animal news, this time of the feline variety.
Yeah, so this one is terrestrial and a lot older and also super cute. researchers uncovered a 35,000-year-old saber-toothed kitten in the Siberian permafrost. They think the kitten was probably around 3 weeks old when it died. But what's really cool here is how well it was preserved. You can see claws and whiskers and a really thick, soft-looking, dark brown fur all over it. This was research published in the journal Scientific Reports.
And I highly recommend that everybody look up pictures of this kitten because it is extremely cute. But I suspect it's best not to play with a saber-toothed kitten. Am I right, Charles?
I'm guessing that would probably not be wise.
All right. Well, on the topic of play, there is news about the Pokemon Go game, which I hadn't heard about in quite some time. What is this news?
Yeah, so this is a game that was launched in 2016 that's of a type known as augmented reality. It uses GPS signals combined with images from your mobile phone's camera to put game images like Pokemon creatures or other things into real-world scenes around you. So if, for example, you went to a place that the game decided contained one of these Pokemon and you looked through your phone's camera, you'd see the Pokemon hiding next to a real tree in your neighborhood, mm-hmm. for example, right? The news this week is that Niantic, the developers of the game, also were using all those millions of pictures that people were taking to train an AI, and they actually used it to develop navigation software.
I mean, is there anything that isn't being used to train AI these days?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a pressing issue, right? You think about artists and authors who are upset about their work being slurped into these AI models without their permission. But, you know, here this is pictures taken by people who thought they were just playing a game.
Yeah, well, this is something we'll definitely be seeing more of, I suspect. But we have time for one more story, and this is also on the topic of games. But we're talking about chimps, right?
Right. So, you know, play is a thing that the young of many animal species do. It's a way for kids, children, young to learn about the world around them and try out things safely. But sadly, most animals stop being quite so playful as they age. And humans are an exception to that, right? Adult humans still play, whether you're in a softball league or you have a weekly poker night. But now researchers are reporting in the journal Current Biology that it turns out adult chimps also play even when they're older. They found that some chimps, like people, continue to play throughout their entire lives. And they think this is especially important before engaging in some kind of act that requires collective cooperation. So play helps you work together.
Well, that is just some lovely news to send us off into the weekend. Thank you so much, Charles.
You bet, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Sci-Fi senior producer Charles Berquist. After the break on Lucy's 50th discovery anniversary, how this ancient skeleton transformed our understanding of human evolution. Stick around. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. On November 24th, 1974, 50 years ago this week, a pair of paleoanthropologists made the discovery of a lifetime, a set of 47 bones hidden in the dusty, rocky hills of a fossil site in Hadar, Ethiopia. The skeleton belonged to a 3.2 million-year-old hominin nicknamed Lucy. She marked the very first specimen of Australopithecus afarensis, a species of early hominins that were very likely our own ancestors. Lucy might be the most famous fossil in the world, and she's transformed our understanding of human evolution. So today, we're looking back at 50 years of Lucy with the people who know her best. The paleo legend who discovered her, Dr. Don Johanson, founding director of the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University, and Dr. Zarai Alemseged, paleoanthropologist at the University of Chicago. Welcome to Science Friday and welcome back.
Happy to be here. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So Don, I want to start with you. Can you believe it's been 50 years? How are you feeling this week?
Well, you know, I went back to Ethiopia a couple of times this year and saw Lucy after 50 years, and she didn't look a day older. But I look in the mirror in the morning when I shave and I realize that 50 years is quite a long time. It is amazing to think about how quickly that time has gone and how well known Lucy has become and what an impact she's had, not only on the average person's thinking about human origins, but on the science itself.
Take me back to that day where you discovered Lucy. What were you doing? How did you find her?
Well, it was a Sunday morning, and my student, Tom Gray, and I were out recording the location of a discovery of a beautiful pig. We think pigs are beautiful at 3.2 million years. And on the way back to our Land Rover, it was getting, you know, well over 100 degrees, and we were thinking about going for a swim in the river and having some lunch, but I am always looking at the ground. So I happened to look over my right shoulder and I spotted a little fragment of bone, just about 2 inches long, that had looked like a wrench with a little notch in it. And it's part of the forearm bone that allows us to flex and extend at the elbow. And it looked peculiar to me because I thought at first it was probably a baboon. It was so small. But as I bent down, picked it up, and looked at it, I could see that it was not a baboon. It was not from an antelope or a gazelle. It was from a human ancestor. And as we kneeled down and looked closer at the ground, we saw bits of a skull, bits of a lower jaw, bits of ribs, And I realized that right there at my feet was a partial skeleton, which I knew was older than 3 million years. I didn't know who it was, but I had no idea that she would be the most famous skeleton found in the 20th century.
So, Zarai, tell me, how did you meet Lucy and how did she inspire you?
Well, when Lucy was discovered, I was a little kid, so I was not aware of her impact. It was not until I was assigned to work at the National Museum of Ethiopia, where Don and his colleagues had stored Lucy, that I started to spend time with Lucy and many other fossils that were discovered from across Ethiopia. So for me, the inspiration and the first contact with Lucy was actually hanging out with her physically on a daily basis.
So growing up in Ethiopia, was Lucy like a local celebrity?
In Ethiopia growing up, she was not as popular as she is today. But clearly, you could find her name in textbooks, in lectures, in some places. But if you go to Ethiopia today, you will see Lucy restaurant, Lucy cafe, Lucy, you name it, you know. So, she has now led to even the naming of the country's motto or logo, which is the land of origins, which I coined. And in order to do that, I obviously leaned on Lucy and many discoveries, including mine, the discovery of Salam, to show that Ethiopia is indeed one of the cradles of mankind, even though Africa broadly is a cradle of mankind.
And Ethiopia is really one of the great centers of human origins research. But we also have to be reminded that she has her own Ethiopian name, which is Dinkanesh, which means that you are wonderful.
Oh.
But everybody seems to know her as Lucy, both here and in Ethiopia.
I've got to get myself to a Lucy Cafe. That sounds wonderful.
And the coffee is good because not only is the country the origin of Lucy, but it's also the origin of coffee. So
sure,
if you go to Lucy Cafe, you will have great coffee accompanied by Lucy.
Wow, that's on my bucket list now. Let's talk a little bit about why Lucy was such an important discovery. Don, can you pick, let's say, two of the most profound things that we've learned from Lucy in the past 50 years?
Well, I think one of the most profound things we learned was that she was a new species. She was a new kind of human ancestor. She was a Australopithecus, that tongue twister, but she was very different from all other species. And with that recognition came the realization that we had to look again at the geometry of the human family tree. Where did she sit on the human family tree? When she was found, the predominant view was that the common ancestor to our own genus, Homo, we are Homo sapiens, and other kinds, other species of Australopithecus, was Australopithecus africanus from South Africa. Now she was placed at the pivotal place on the tree, where she, roughly around 3 million years ago, gave rise to at least two, probably three different lineages. And one of those lineages ultimately led to us, Homo sapiens, through a very complicated pathway. But she became the last common ancestor for all those later humans.
Mm-hmm. Zarai, what is on Lucy's highlight reel for you?
Well, you know, what Lucy did was the discovery of the small brain in Lucy and also upright walking. It sealed the deal. That is, yes, upright walking came before small brain, and we did not need the large brain that we have today to become part of a member of the human lineage. I think that was one of the main contributions of Lucy.
Don, have we learned everything that we can from Lucy in that time? I mean, has her time come and gone, or is there still more to learn?
Well, you know, when we talk about Lucy, we really talk about her species, Australopithecus afarensis. I would say that there will always be something new. There was a recent wonderful article that Zarai participated in, where they began to reconstruct brain capacities in virtual space, which was not really possible before then. We know that now they were about 30% larger brains than the average for a chimpanzee. So there is something going on in terms of selection for larger brains. So I would say that as new techniques become available, we will find a lot more information. And as we look at her through a different theoretical telescope, we may change her place on the tree. I'm sure much more will be learned.
Zarai, I want to ask you about this fossil that has been nicknamed Lucy's Baby. Tell us about her and how did you find her?
Yes, so I was working at a site called Dukika, which is not far from Hadar, where Lucy was found. And obviously, I expected to make discoveries, but I never would have thought of discovering such an amazingly complete skeleton. It is over 60% complete. It is a child that died at the age of 2.5, dated to 3.2 million years ago, which is 150,000 years older than Lucy. But what was important about the discovery is most of the bones that we find, including Lucy, come from adult individuals. And that is because the juvenile, the infants, their skeletons are fragile, so they disintegrate or get chewed by scavengers. So in many ways, when you work just on adults, the sample size you have is biased. Just think of someone from Mars coming to the planet Earth, and you would hide all the children, and they'll study only the grown-ups. Right. And they will go report. They say, well, humans are this high, this tall, this big, but they're ignoring the children. So in many ways, what Salam or Lucy's child did is brought new information that completes the picture that has already been drawn by Don and his colleagues. So it's a unique and amazing addition to our knowledge of the Lucy species, but broadly speaking, early humans.
Don, you have had quite the career, and that's putting it mildly. What has motivated you to spend so many years searching for our origins?
Well, it really came from reading about human origins when I was a teenager. And the book that startled me was Man's Place in Nature, which stated that we and the African apes shared a common ancestor. Therefore, our oldest ancestors should be found in Africa. And I think that the title continues to be exceedingly important to me and relevant today, Man's Place in Nature, because for a long time, people in anthropology have thought that culture makes us above the natural world. And I think that we are still part of the natural world. And I think every time we find one of these fossils, of course, it was a missing, so it was a missing link. But I think more importantly, it's a link to the natural world in which we live. And I think everybody has this question sometime in their lives, usually when they're very young. Where did I come from? How did I get here? And we are fortunate on this planet as Homo sapiens to have the curiosity and the ability to go back and to actually find that evidence. And it deeply sets us in the framework of the natural world.
In the grand scheme of evolution, is our species all that unique, in your opinion?
Well, we are. We have a certain level of uniqueness. Each species does. We are unique because we are a combination of both biological evolution, which is glacially very slow, genetic change is slow, but also cultural evolution. And we are a creature that is actually not because we wanted it, but we're in control of the future of the planet, and we're not doing a very good job. So I think every species is unique, and we have to recognize that and understand that we are not the end point in evolutionary change. We were not destined to be. We're here because we have survived the whims and caprices of climate change, of challenges that we don't even know about. And we should cherish that and really appreciate the fact that we're alive, because a few genes different and you wouldn't be you. Zarai wouldn't be Zarai. I wouldn't be me. We have been given the gift of the universe.
Zarai, in studying human evolution, has it changed how you think about humanity?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a privilege to study human origins. You know, as Don says, we are unique, yes, but the fish is unique also, and the frog is, as is the antelope. So our uniqueness should not dictate that we feel detached from nature, because we are integral part of nature. You know, I jokingly ask my students at the University of Chicago, are you more or less evolved than the fish? And all of them would answer, we are more evolved. Well, I will put you in the ocean and we will see who is more evolved. So unless we contextualize our understanding of being human, it is going to be difficult for us to interact, at least to continue interact with nature as we destroy it in terms of global warming and climate change and acid acidification. As we destroy and kill any species, it's going to come back and haunt us. And that's why understanding our place in nature and really determining how we want to interact with nature is going to determine our own survival or not. The species that Lucy and Salam belong to, we call it primitive ancient species, but they managed to survive for close to 1 million years. Homo sapiens have been on the planet only for 200,000, 300,000 years ago, so we need to be a little humble and have respect for the past and ensure that we can actually have the future. So it's a combination of understanding the past and then so we can work on present and then try to forecast the future is what excites me and what inspires me to do what I do.
Mm-hmm. How has Lucy's discovery changed the field of paleoanthropology in Ethiopia over the past 50 years?
When I began in 1970, a long time ago, to my first trip to Ethiopia, there were no Ethiopian scholars. There were only foreign scientists who came and did their research and left. And it's very, very gratifying that over the years, quite a number of Ethiopian-born scholars are now at the forefront of the research. And in addition to that, in the 1970s, there was really no place for us to work. There was a very old museum, but there was no place that was dedicated to storing and working on these fossils. Today, there's a major building that was constructed by the government of Ethiopia that invites scholars from all over the world to come and study those fossils in contemporary modern laboratories. And as Zarai said, it is now called country of origins, and our origins, in fact, of many origins. Lucy and these fossils have dramatically changed the worldview of Ethiopia.
Well, just yesterday at the University of Chicago, my PhD student graduated. He earned his PhD effectively working on the Lucy species. So basically, this would be Don's grandchild in some way. And if not for the inspiration that came from Lucy and many other discoveries, including mine, I don't think you would be interviewing me today. I don't think you would be interviewing Don today. So, yes, you can make many discoveries. And Lucy is not the only fossil. We have so many hundreds and thousands of fossils, both human and non-human. But you always need that iconic specimen that is going to catch your imagination so you can then think broadly. And then ask the question, where do we come from? And in regards to what happens locally in Ethiopia, I think what Lucy did is inspired young people like myself to not only train themselves, but train others, inspire the government to invest in paleoanthropology and build this lovely building for us to do research, but also inspire the public. So now in grade 4 textbook, you will see my name on page 5 or 6, where kids will say, Ethiopian anthropologist Zarai who discovered Salam. So it's just this, gestalt, everything put together, the Lucy impact is simply huge, and it never stops. Lucy continues to be the benchmark for any discovery. You cannot run away from Lucy.
Well, what a wonderful place to end. I would like to thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Dr. Don Johanson, founding director of the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University, and Dr. Zarai Alemseged, paleoanthropologist at the University of Chicago. After the break, it took more than 50 days for Asheville to restore its potable water supply after Hurricane Helene. The how and the why coming up. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. When Hurricane Helene barreled through the southeast U.S. in September, it dumped an estimated 40 trillion gallons of water onto the region. That resulted in immense flooding, which destroyed roads, buildings, power lines, and other infrastructure. And it also impacted the region's potable water supply. For weeks, residents in Asheville didn't have access to drinking water, which comes from a local reservoir. And we actually heard from two listeners based in Asheville who had some questions about why this purification process can take so long.
Hi, Science Friday. This is Sarah.
And Allison.
From Asheville, North Carolina.
Unfortunately, the storm destroyed all of the main distribution lines coming from our reservoir, leaving the entire city without running water for weeks. But now that those lines are mainly functional, the reservoir turbidity levels are so high that they cannot run the sediment-filled water through our treatment plant.
We'd like to know more about the science behind the turbidity issue and why, even though it has been dry for weeks after the storm, the sediment won't settle. It feels like this is an intersection of geology, chemistry, even physics that impacts our everyday lives. So we might as well be curious and learn from it.
We love the show so much. Thank you. And also, we'd like to say thanks to all the Water Resource Department employees and outside helpers that have been working tirelessly on this issue on behalf of the city of Asheville.
That was recorded shortly before limited potable water access was restored earlier this week, marking the first time in 53 days that its residents didn't have to boil tap water. So why can it take so long for cities to clean their potable water after a storm like this? And what could other regions expect from the aftermath of future extreme weather? Here to tell us more is my guest, Dr. Sarah Ledford, Associate Professor of Geosciences at Georgia State University, based in Atlanta, Georgia. She studies the role and impact of water in urban areas. Dr. Ledford, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you sum up for listeners what's happened to Asheville's water and the region since Hurricane Helene?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's really been three steps in the process after waters receded. The first is the rebuilding of any infrastructure that was washed out. So if pipes were washed away, those had to be rebuilt. We had to get power back up to the water treatment plant. Mm-hmm. The second problem is exactly what the callers were talking about, which was the unprecedented volume of water that came in washed huge amounts of sediment into the reservoir. And in the mountains of North Carolina, that includes a lot of clays. And clays take a long time to settle to the bottom, but we can't put that water through the drinking water process until those clays are removed. And so that's a lot of what the Asheville Water Department was working on, was trying to do what they could to speed up that process of clay settling. And then the final problem is that after the water is potable at the drinking water plant, the entire system has to be flushed so that we can make sure all pipes throughout the whole distribution network have clean and safe water.
So it sounds to me like, you know, city treatment plants are set up to filter certain things, but maybe they're not set up to filter things that are unusual, like clay.
Yeah, for many places, especially ones that pull water from a drinking water reservoir, that reservoir is sort of the assumed place where settling will happen. Other places that might pull water from a stream or river may actually have a tank in their system where they do settling. But when you have a reservoir that usually does this process very well for you, why would you build extra infrastructure that you don't typically need?
Yeah. So our listeners mentioned that the water in the reservoir has a high turbidity level. I'm not very familiar with this concept. So what is high turbidity and what does it have to do with potable water?
So high turbidity is basically a measure of how much light gets scattered by water. When you have water that is very clear, light that you put into that water can go on basically forever before it gets scattered or reflected back to the measurement device. Huh. When you have water that is full of sediment, especially clays, that light can't get very far before it reflects back to you. And it looks cloudy to us as humans. And so high turbidity is used as a surrogate measure for high sediment in the water.
So our listeners, Sarah and Allison, asked why the sediment in the water is negatively charged and flat-shaped. How does that impact the purification process?
Yeah, clays are a byproduct of a lot of long, long processes of weathering of rock. And clay minerals, which make up most of what we colloquially call clay, are what are called phyllosilicates. And these are a class of minerals that are formed in sheets. And so that's why the clay is flat. is that the way that all of the atoms are bonded together results in sheet-like formations. The other thing that clays have is they have a high static electricity on the outside of the clays, because those oxygen atoms that are at the outside of those bonds result in those sheets of clay having a negative charge on the outside. And then when negative comes close to negative, or two clay particles come near each other, they're going to repel each other because they're both negative.
So our next question is also from our listeners.
They're using aluminum sulfate and caustic soda to try and bring the turbidity down. How do those chemicals interact with the sediment?
So yeah, how do you even begin to clean this?
So what they're using are actually techniques that are typically used at wastewater treatment plants, because this is a process we do when we treat wastewater at the other end of the system. They're trying to get the sediment to form into flocks. And what that means are just larger particles. So the chemicals that they're adding are trying to overcome that negative repelling action and cause clay particles to start to stick together. And then the larger and larger the particle becomes, the easier it is for gravity to pull it to the bottom of the lake. And then they can pull the clean water from the top of the lake into the drinking water plant to be treated.
Okay. So our most recent update from Asheville is that the water is safe to drink, but it's not totally clean yet. And city officials are recommending to not use large amounts of the water for landscaping and long showers. How long might it take for things to get completely normal?
The good news is that if the city is saying it's safe to drink, that means that there's no bacteria or pathogens in the water. And as humans, that's really one of our biggest concerns about safe drinking water, is we don't want anything that's going to make us sick in the water. Mm-hmm. From my reading, it sounds like the turbidity is still a little bit high, but it's coming down very quickly and much closer to the pre-Helene conditions. And so I don't know that we really have a clock at this point, because the city has said it's safe to drink. The other question, though, I think really has to do with the volume of water, and that's probably why they're encouraging folks not to water their lawns. They want to make sure that the water is being used for the most important purposes and for human consumption, because it may still be waiting for other parts of the lake to have the turbidity come down, and we don't want to pull too much volume off the lake into the treatment plant.
Mm-hmm. So after the hurricane, there was a lot of news around Asheville that it could no longer be considered a climate haven. We're going to continue to see more extreme weather events like this in the future. Can other regions expect this kind of problem with their drinking water if it's based in an open-air reservoir that, you know, maybe they haven't experienced before?
I think absolutely. I think what we know about climate change is that it's increasing the ability of the atmosphere to hold water vapor, which means extreme precipitation events are going to become more likely. The other compounding factor that we get in regards to drinking water reservoirs and climate change is wildfires. Mm. One of the things that helps keep sediment from flowing off the environment into a drinking water reservoir is the vegetation that holds all of that material in place. I think another really big risk that we have coming forward is if areas that have had wildfires come through get large rain events on them afterwards that are areas that are source water for a drinking water reservoir, we're very likely to have a similar problem, potentially even with less rain.
Is there a way for local governments to prepare for this?
Continuing to try and make sure your source water area is protected, that it's not being developed, because that's going to be the best chance that we have for keeping vegetation in place. I think that's a really key piece of the puzzle. Another one is continuing to use controlled burns to mimic the natural wildfire patterns, which will then hopefully decrease the ability for a very extreme wildfire to come through and do as much damage, is another key piece.
Mm-hmm. So you study community engagement in urban water management. Do you have any thoughts about how residents of Asheville and other cities can get more involved in their water systems in this kind of context?
Yeah, I always encourage everyone to try and do what they can to understand where the money that they pay in their bills is going. So you're paying a water and a sewer bill every month if you're getting drinking water from a centralized system like this. How is that money being distributed? I also encourage people to continue to try and understand the double whammy that many drinking water facilities are facing, which is the potential that they're going to have to treat new and more difficult chemicals, for example, PFAS concerns, while also making up for the fact that across the United States, overall, we've underinvested in our infrastructure and we're having to play catch up to repair it and get it back up to the best quality.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is all the time that we have for now. Thank you so much for explaining this to us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Sarah Ledford, Associate Professor of Geosciences at Georgia State University based in Atlanta. And thank you to our listeners, Sarah and Allison from Asheville, North Carolina, for writing in. If you have a science question about an issue in your city, you can reach out to us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. That's scifry@sciencefriday.com. And to close out the hour, it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. As we're seeing sea levels rise across the world, we're also seeing how communities close to the water are responding differently to it. In Louisiana's Grand Bayou Indian Village near New Orleans, tribes are witnessing their historic lands disappear underwater. And their solution, for now, is oysters. Here to tell us more is my guest, Eva Tesfaye, coastal reporter at WWNO in New Orleans. Eva, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us about what this tribe has been going through?
Yeah, so like you said, Grand Bayou Indian Village, it's about an hour south of New Orleans. It's in Plaquemines Parish along the Mississippi River. It's home to the Atakapa Ishakshawasha tribe. It's a very small village. In the 40s, there was about 1,000 people living there, and now there's only about a dozen. They live in the marsh, and you can only get around by boat. So that means all the homes have been raised on stilts to help deal with hurricanes, and they've lost a lot of people. A lot of people have moved out, but they're also losing land, and that's obviously due to sea level rise that's driven by climate change, and it's causing their land to disappear.
And I've heard that this is getting so bad that GPS maps aren't even accurate anymore. Is that right?
Yeah. One person I was talking to while I was down there says sometimes you'll be like looking at the GPS and you'll see land on the map, and then you just look up and it's all water.
Oh my gosh. So tell me how oysters play into all of this.
Right. So this was a project between Grand Bayou and the Coalition to Protect Coastal Louisiana. Basically, the coalition brought a bunch of volunteers and a bunch of bags of recycled oyster shells, and they had the volunteers stack the shells all along the shoreline in front of people's houses. So these shells will help slow the water and help protect that land from erosion, but it's also a living reef. So oysters will attach, it'll create this beautiful little ecosystem, and that means the reef will also grow as the sea level rises and continue providing that protection.
And you were there. Was it easy to see the effect that these oysters were having?
Yeah, so this was the second time the coalition has done this kind of project with Grand Bayou. They actually chose to do this to protect one of their sacred mounds first. That's called the Lemon Tree Mound. So we went to go see how that reef was doing. It was installed about 2 years ago, and Richie Blink was the boat captain. He took us out there. He runs Delta Discovery Tours. He pointed out how the oysters and other critters are already attaching to the reef.
So this is an oyster drill conch. So this is a predatory snail that actually eats oysters. So that's just telling us that there's oysters that are actually here.
Yeah.
Fishermen don't like these very much.
So there are all these snails and crabs and things attached to the reef. And what I also noticed is you could really see how the reef is slowing down the water. Like there's waves on one side, but the water between the oyster reef and the mound was almost completely still.
Wow. So I can imagine we're talking about a lot of oysters here, right? Where is the tribe getting them?
Yeah, the reef they built to protect their homes was 900 feet long. So yeah, that's like thousands of oyster shells. Wow. And yeah, they get them from restaurants in New Orleans. The coalition also just expanded to collecting from restaurants in Baton Rouge. So it's kind of a nice way to recycle these oyster shells and bring them back into the environment.
So this starts with recycled oyster shells, but then it becomes a place for living oysters and other kinds of marine animals. At the same time, it makes flooding from storms less of an issue, but they can only help so much, I'm guessing. Is that a correct read on that?
Yeah, I talked to Rosina Philippe. She's a tribal council member and the tribe's knowledge holder, and she talked about that. She basically said they know it won't be enough to stop the land from disappearing completely, especially for Lemon Tree Mound.
It will eventually, you know, succumb to the waters and the waves, which is okay. But the reef that was created there will serve as not only a marker of where that site was, but it actually encourages marine life to congregate there and to repopulate the area.
So basically, it's worth it anyway, because they're taking care of not only their land, but they're also taking care of the marine environment.
Mm-hmm. So what would this tribe do if their land disappears?
Well, they're not going to leave. Philippe made that very clear to me, that this is their home and they're going to stay no matter what. And like I said, they already raised their homes on stilts. They're also looking into floating houses and gardens and other adaptation methods. Philippe says they're historically a water people, like they would move to adapt to the water as it changed historically. So now they're just returning to that way of life and relearning how to live with water.
Well, that's all the time that we have for now. I'd like to thank my guest, Eva Tesfaye, Coastal Desk reporter for WWNO in New Orleans. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
One last thing before we go. Are you thinking about getting books for the curious young minds in your life, but you need some suggestions? We're covering the best science books for kids from this year, and we want to know more about who you have plans to shop for this holiday season. Go to sciencefriday.com/kidsbooks to send us your requests, and we'll ask our experts for an upcoming story. That's sciencefriday.com/kidsbooks. And that's it for this hour. Lots of folks helped make the show happen this week, including
Jordan Smudgick,
Charles Bergquist,
Shoshana Buxbaum,
George Harper.
Thanks, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of the program or you want to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. You can email us too. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. I'm Kathleen Davis. Thanks for listening. This is Science Friday. I'm SciFry producer Kathleen Davis. Every holiday season, I have one thing on my mind, and that is food. So in celebration, we've got a full hour of food science coming right up. We'll debunk some nutrition myths, dig into some potato science, and learn how to make plant-based meat meatier. But first on the menu, a story of shipwrecked rye. In 1878, a wooden schooner named the James R. Bentley set sail from Chicago to Buffalo, New York, carrying a large shipment of rye. But strong winds and rough waters damaged the ship, and it sank to the bottom of Lake Huron. The crew was saved, but the rye went down with the ship. Now, almost 150 years later, a Michigan-based team dove to the shipwreck and rescued the rye seeds, and they're trying to bring the long-lost rye back to life. Joining me to talk about this wonderful story are my guests, Dr. Eric Olson, professor of wheat breeding and genetics at Michigan State University in East Lansing, and Chad Munger, founder and CEO of Mammoth Distilling, based in Bel Air, Michigan. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks for having us.
So, Chad, let's start with why this rye is so special. So tell us a little bit about this rye that went down with the Bentley.
So we don't know yet that the rye as a grain is special, but it's historically significant and fits into a much larger narrative about rye in the state of Michigan, actually. And at Mammoth, we are a traditional, small, very small craft distillery, interested in making things with the most local ingredients that we can, grains and fruits. And we discovered 5 years ago that Michigan has a very unique history with rye. In fact, in the early 1900s, Michigan was the largest producer and exporter of rye in North America. And we discovered that the variety of rye, Rosin, that was responsible for all that growing and selling in the early 20th century, was created at Michigan State, was propagated at Michigan State, which is a story unto itself. That led us down a rabbit hole of thinking about other ryes and the possibility of creating a rye specifically for the distilling industry. The story of Rosin Rye grabbed a lot of attention from folks in Kentucky and Tennessee who spend mm-hmm. their time making a lot of bourbon, which includes rye. People learned about the Rosen Rye Project, including a guy named Ross Richardson, who is a professional shipwreck diver and an expert in Great Lakes shipwreck history, contacted us and said, I've discovered a shipwreck. This shipwreck is very interesting because it has rye whiskey in the hold. Are you guys interested in talking about what we might do with a shipwreck like this, since you're obviously interested in Michigan agricultural history? We said, absolutely. And that conversation led to a conversation that we had with him. He said, I have a friend who owns a shipwreck in Lake Huron, which is a shocking thing to hear.
Right.
And he said, I have some wood from that wreck. And would you be interested in having that wood to use in an aging project on some of the whiskey you make? So we absolutely said yes to that. But when he handed me the box of wood, it had on it an 8.5-11 sheet of paper that had been photocopied 150 times and was barely legible. But the middle of it said, this ship was full of rye grain. And as soon as I saw that written, I said, is that real, Ross? Is that actually what's in that ship? And is there any left? And he said, absolutely. That boat is full of nothing but grain.
Wow.
And so, you know, the short version of that is we cut a deal with them to have access to some of the rye. And part of that deal was we had to let them go get it for us, because that's where the adventurous part of that is what we're all interested in.
Yeah. So let's talk about that adventurous part. So it's my understanding you were part of this team that rescued these seeds. So can you tell us a little bit about what that process was like on the day of the rescue?
It's a dream, right? This is kid stuff. Three divers who do this for a living, Paul, Ross, and Dusty, right out of Central Casting, right? They are professional shipwreck divers. And when you see pictures of them, you know it immediately. So they brought two boats to Lake Huron, and they used things in their garage, I think, to come up with three really ingenious collection tools, which could be extract grain from the hulls and then could be sealed underwater so that it wouldn't leak out on the way back up, and that it could be maintained in one place on ice for the trip back to East Lansing, because 38-degree water with no oxygen keeps things intact. But as soon as those things warm up or come in contact with oxygen, they begin to degrade immediately. In fact, as soon as you got it to the surface, you smelled it, and it's really not very pleasant.
By the time you got them, Eric, what was the state of the seeds?
Oh, it was a mixed bag of seed quality. Now, and it was certainly related to where the grain was situated on the grain pile in the hold of the ship. On the interior, roughly half of the grain sample was bright in color, very much intact. You know, you could still distinguish all of the components. You could see the embryo end, the brush end, and the grain itself was very much intact. And so they were imbibed with water. So they were a little bit squishy, but, you know, if you accidentally squeezed a seed too hard, you would actually see that starch.
Wow.
There was 160-year-old carbohydrates left in that grain.
Yeah.
I mean, it was still very much intact.
So you get these seeds into the lab. How did you try to get them to germinate?
Right. So plants use hormones, just like mammals. You know, they have a hormone system that controls their growth and development. And seed germination is just one of those normal developmental pathways that's triggered by, in this case, the hormone gibberellic acid. And so this is, you know, folks that work with seeds that are dormant, this is pretty conventional to apply concentrated gibberellic acid to these seeds just to jumpstart this process. So, you know, we applied it to some of the grain that came directly out of the water. So right away, starting the germination process. But then others, we applied a cold treatment and then germinating them at room temperature. It didn't work either. But we were undeterred. We kept going. And so we dried some of the seed down to simulate that natural process of seeds absorbing water from their environment. That's part of the germination process. So we were trying to simulate a more natural germination process. Well, that didn't work either. But it wasn't the end of the road. You know, we weren't done right there. We were undeterred. So it wasn't just that we couldn't get the seeds to germinate. There's, you know, with the ultimate goal of reviving this rye variety for production in Michigan, you know, we're not done yet with just the attempts to germinate that seed. There's still more to do.
Well, so what are you trying to do now?
While we may not have generated plants from the seed, what was left in that seed is essentially the blueprint for Bentley rye, which is the genome, the DNA, right? Because those seeds were very much intact, the starchy part of the grain actually contains about 30% more DNA than the actual roots, the stems and leaves and those tissues, right? So there's it's got extra DNA in there, extra genome. We isolated DNA directly from those seeds, and we're going to move forward with sequencing from end to end for all seven of those rye chromosomes. We're going to get a contiguous sequence of those A's, T's, C's, and G's. Those chromosomes that are present in the Bentley rye are present in other rye varieties, modern rye varieties. So modern rye varieties contain segments of DNA that are identical, or we will find these segments that are identical to those chromosome segments in the Bentley rye. And we'll essentially be able to reverse engineer the Bentley rye genome from modern varieties just using modern plant breeding techniques. So we'll be able to hybridize different rye varieties that have shared segments of their chromosomes and find those chromosomes that are bringing together essentially the complete genome then of the Bentley rye variety.
So, Chad, what is the goal here if you're able to resuscitate this rye?
Our very large picture goal is to create a brand new variety of rye made specifically for the distilling industry. So modern plant breeding focuses almost entirely on maximizing yield in grain. Mm-hmm. And that's great. That provides a lot of calories and a lot of fuel for the world. But it does it at the expense, typically, of the character of the grains that are being modified. In this situation, we're going to breed for two things: better agronomic properties, so better root structure, better stem structure, higher yield in the field. But at the same time, we're going to breed for characteristics that make these better food products. For us, mm-hmm. whiskey, so whiskey with more character, whiskey with more 4VG, which is one of the compounds that makes rye spicy when you make whiskey out of it, and other things. And we're going to do them at the same time. So the interest the industry has in the Rose and Rye project that we started is we hope will continue on with a brand new variety of rye created specifically for the industry that makes it more attractive to growers and more attractive to distillers, not just in Michigan, but in Kentucky and Tennessee, where the vast majority of distilling in this country goes on. So effectively creating a brand new market for a very old grain and reintroducing a market economy that thrived in Michigan 120 years ago and then disappeared.
And so it sounds like different varieties of rye will affect how a whiskey tastes. Do you have any predictions for what Bentley rye whiskey might taste like?
I don't think we do. And it's got obvious historic value here. It provides us with access to genes that just don't exist in seed banks today. So it extends the genes that we can select from when we're making this whiskey. But we don't know with any certainty that the genes out of the Bentley rye will be the perfect grain for us for our purposes here. But almost certainly some portion of it will be. The first exciting thing we're going to do is see what Bentley rye looks like and tastes like when you grow it out at scale. And from then, we're going to take the best portions of that and combine it with the best portions of the varieties that we already have in hand. We know Rose and Rye is a premium product that we can grow here in Michigan. So very likely that some elements, some genes from Rosen and genes from Bentley will be combined. But there are other varieties that Eric's dealing with that are proven agronomically around the world. As climate change is happening, and it's certainly happening to us here in Michigan, rye is an important crop because it, at its very nature, is very sustainable, right? It's drought, mm-hmm. drought tolerant. Soil conditions can vary widely and it still can thrive. And as things warm up, Michigan becomes a more and more exciting place to be growing rye. So we're going to select for characteristics that make it even more tolerant in the environment that we have to offer here in Michigan. And this is a long-term play to make Michigan a viable source of grain for the world.
Well, I'll have to ask you to send me a bottle of that Bentley rye once it's up and running, but we have run out of time. This was such a wonderful conversation. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you so much. This is a thrill.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thanks for having us.
Dr. Eric Olson is a professor of wheat breeding and genetics at Michigan State University, and Chad Munger is the founder and CEO of Mammoth Distilling in Bel Air, Michigan. After the break, debunking some nutrition misinformation. Stick around. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. We recently asked you, our listeners, which dubious health claims you've been seeing in your social media feeds or being circulated by friends and family. Unsurprisingly, we received a ton of questions about nutrition. So today we're going to answer some of your nutrition questions with the help of an expert, Jessica Clifford, registered dietitian and nutrition specialist at the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Colorado State University, based in Fort Collins. Jessica, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're so glad to have you. So let's get right in to our listener questions. The first one that we have is from Lynn S. She's based in Syracuse, New York. She asks, why are internet comment sections freaking out about seed oils? Okay, Jessica, first of all, what is a seed oil?
Well, seed oils are those oils that are extracted from the seed of a plant. And generally, they contain unsaturated fats. Seed oils include oils like canola oil or corn oil, cottonseed oil, soybean oil, sunflower oil, and safflower oil, among a few others. That is what a seed oil is.
And so why are people concerned about these?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we see across, you know, media platforms is that there is some concern about the way that these seed oils are processed. And that is often through the form of like heat and the use of a solvent, which is commonly hexane. Now, hexane is a toxic compound, right? But research shows that really there's a very, very tiny amount in the oils that we're actually consuming. And so really there's very little reason for concern with that level of the oil that we're eating. When you hear of a compound like hexane, you automatically might think like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. Of course, we shouldn't be consuming it. But it's really not showing that it's harmful to our health in the amount that we're consuming. And in fact, the benefits that we see from some of the oils, right, because they're made up of these unsaturated fats, can outweigh the risks that come with them as it relates to that hexane compound. And then another thing I think that draws concern for some people and maybe leads to some of this misinformation related to seed oils is the fact that they contain omega-6 fatty acids. So that might come up in discussions around seed oils, right? I was just going to say omega-6 fatty acids are known to be, they're pro-inflammatory. And so these oils do contain these omega-6 fatty acids, but it doesn't necessarily make them inherently bad.
Okay. So how does canola oil compare to an olive oil, for example, nutritionally?
So canola oil has unsaturated fats, so monounsaturated fatty acids, as well as polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are heart-healthy unsaturated fats, and so does olive oil. But the thing that differs with olive oil is that it also contains these other bioactive compounds, like phenolic compounds, which have anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties. So there may be some advantage that olive oil has over canola oil or maybe other seed oils, but the seed oils do also have heart-healthy fats. Mm-hmm.
So Jessica, give us a verdict. Overall, is seed oil bad for you?
I would say no, it's definitely not bad for you. Again, everything should be consumed in moderation. So it's not like you want to rely solely only on one type of seed oil, but it definitely can be consumed as part of a healthy diet.
Okay. So this next question that we have comes from David K. in West Richland, Washington. He asks, I'm skeptical about the way all processed foods have been lumped into a single category, from cooked mashed potatoes to hyper-processed hot dogs laced with preservative chemicals that I can't even pronounce. Are all processed foods supposed to be bad for my health? Okay, Jessica, let's talk about this question. What does it actually mean for a food to be processed versus ultra processed?
Yeah, so a processed food, so the definition of just processed food in general is any raw agricultural commodity or food that has been altered from its original state or its like whole food form, right? But there are, as you said, these various levels of processing. So you really can't lump them all together. Even like slicing an apple is a form of processing, but we all know that just cutting an apple makes it no less healthy, right? That's not going to change the nutrition of an apple. A food becomes ultra-processed when there are things added like preservatives, flavorings, colors, and other food additives such as like added salt, sugars, and fats, particularly for flavor and shelf life. So really, you could think of it like a spectrum of processing. So on the left side, you might have that sliced apple, and then all the way to the right might be that hot dog or that cellophane packaged cupcake.
Mm-hmm. There has been a lot of research into quote-unquote ultra-processed foods recently. What do we know about their effect on our health?
Well, research shows that people who eat more processed foods gain weight, you know, maybe more weight and more quickly. And it's interesting because it's not just because they're eating more energy-dense foods, right, that are higher in calories but lower in nutrients, but also because the way the foods are engineered is actually making people eat more of them, right? It's that perfect concoction of like sugar, salt, and fat that really makes people want more. And it's actually triggering something in our brain to making us want to eat more of them. And so, and then research also shows that greater exposure of those sort of ultra processed foods is associated with increased risk of heart disease related death, as well as diabetes, among other things. We want to have a healthy relationship with food, and really all foods can fit into a healthy diet. And so we don't want to make it about like demonizing certain foods and saying you can never eat this food or this is horrible and you should never have this. Because really, I think having even some of these ultra processed foods that some people might enjoy once in a while can be okay and can fit as part of a healthy lifestyle and a healthy diet. But I do think from a public health sense, that, you know, I really do think our food industry could use a little work in terms of providing or making less ultra-processed foods, for sure.
So once in a while, my McDonald's quarter pounder is okay to eat, but in moderation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to something that I've heard about for quite some time, and that is the health benefits of apple cider vinegar. People have attributed this to weight loss, lowering blood sugar, lowering cholesterol. Is there evidence to support these claims?
Yeah, so this sort of information has been out for such a long time, you know, in the media and even in research around this. There is some evidence. I think, you know, apple cider vinegar has been touted to have so many benefits. And while I think some are true to some degree, they may not be to the degree that some media or people are saying. I think first and foremost, the one thing where there's the most research or the strongest research to support is that apple cider vinegar can help to lower blood glucose levels or A1C levels, but the effect is minimal. So it's nothing huge. It's nothing earth-shattering. If someone has prediabetes or diabetes, this should definitely not replace any medications they're on or other lifestyle changes that would be recommended. But it could be used in addition or, you know, in an adjunct to medication or and or healthy eating or exercise. And then you mentioned weight loss. So there is some research showing that it can help possibly with weight loss as well. But the research doesn't seem to be as strong as that with its effects on blood glucose.
Mm-hmm.
And really with weight loss, it's so complicated. So, you know, it's not necessarily a sustainable solution, I think, to weight loss. And it definitely wouldn't be like a silver bullet here, right? It could maybe help a little bit, but it's not to the degree that's being presented in the media. And I do want to say one more thing related to that, if that's okay. With that said, you know, even despite some of these minor benefits, apple cider vinegar is very acidic, so it can cause damage to like tooth enamel and your esophagus. So people might experience some sort of upset, stomach upset or acid reflux. So if people do choose to consume this, it should be diluted, or I would recommend that it be diluted with water or like added to a tea or maybe a salad dressing as opposed to consuming it directly. But again, this should be in conjunction with a healthy diet, right? You can't just drink apple cider vinegar and expect to lose weight or reduce your blood glucose.
But why does it seem that apple cider vinegar specifically has these modest health benefits?
So apple cider vinegar is made by fermenting apple juice with yeast and bacteria, in particular bacteria, a class of bacteria called acetic acid bacteria, to make the vinegar. And so a lot of it, from what we can tell in the research, is due, I think, is due to the effects of that fermentation and how that is impacting, at least related to the blood glucose decrease, it's affecting the absorption of carbohydrates into the blood or the slowed breakdown of the carbohydrates into sugars in our body. And so I really think a lot of it is attributed to the effects of the fermentation.
Uh-huh. So is it possible that other fermented foods have similar benefits?
Maybe, yes. I think it really depends on the bacteria present in the fermentation process and the impacts that those specific bacteria or their byproducts have. Mm-hmm. So it can really vary from product to product, depending on what the food is and what the bacteria are that are doing the fermenting and the impacts that those bacteria or their byproducts would have. But yeah, there could be some of those benefits seen, yes, from other fermented foods.
Got it. Okay, so let's move on to our next topic. There is a group of fruits and vegetables that people are sometimes suspicious of, and these are nightshades. So these are potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants. And some people incorrectly argue that they cause inflammation, but it's my understanding that the opposite is actually true, right?
Yes. Yeah, that is true. I think, you know, like you said, people believe or claiming that these cause inflammation and maybe even other health issues have been mentioned as well. You know, some people may associate this with alkaloids, which is a compound found in these plant foods, but in very small amounts. Though there really is not a large amount of evidence demonstrating that association. So those experiences or what people are saying that, you know, is happening here are generally individual experiences and they're not generalizable. And it's not based on research that has been seen, right? There's really no conclusive scientific evidence to support those claims. And like you said, yep, it's quite the opposite that these foods can actually, most of them, if not all of them, can help fight inflammation and have very many positive health benefits.
So it's possible that some individuals are experiencing inflammation when it's really that's their body and that's their gut versus the entire population.
Yes, exactly. And so some people do have an intolerance for certain foods that they might relate to something that in truth is really something else. And so in those cases, you know, I would really suggest they meet with a registered dietitian to maybe do an elimination diet or something like that to figure out exactly what it is, because it may not be a whole category of foods or, you know, the whole family of nightshade plants.
Right. So every few years, it seems like there's a whole new fad diet. So first it was low fat back in the 90s. And more recently, we've seen keto and low carb diets. Why does it often feel like what is healthy is constantly changing?
I really think this has to do with, I mean, we always hear this, right? We're always like, nutrition is so hard to understand because, like you said, it's always changing. But I think it's hard for folks to navigate because research is constantly underway, right? And there are people out there who might hear something about one small research study that was done on one small thing and really blow that out of proportion or misrepresent what is actually being said. And then they may make it seem like things are changing or there are new recommendations when there are, in fact, not. Right? True recommendations are ones that we as registered dietitians and maybe some other, you know, physicians and other healthcare practitioners might recommend are usually, you know, true recommendations anyway, are usually based on years and years of research that has shown repeated results over time. So I think this idea that it's constantly changing is really just due to some of this spreading of misinformation because research is constantly underway, even though it's not ready to make a recommendation yet, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So what is your advice to listeners who come across nutrition information online and they maybe have a gut feeling that it's not correct and they want to vet it? What do you recommend that people do?
You know, if you're looking to make a decision on your own, if you come across some information online, well, I've got about five tips that I might recommend. And I think first, people should consider who's offering the information, right? Who is this coming from? What are their credentials and what's their purpose? Right. And even if someone has credentials, I think folks should consider if those individuals or that individual represents a for-profit or if they're an influencer trying to make money or garner a following. Right. Really think critically about who that is. Number two, I think folks should think critically about the recommendations that promise a quick fix or provide any sort of dramatic advice. Right. If the claim sounds too good to be true or maybe a little crazy, they probably are. Number three, think about if this suggestion or this advice is providing lists of like black and white lists, like good or bad foods, or maybe they use the word toxic, or they talk about removing foods or even whole food groups from the diet. That's another red flag for sure. And number four, folks should determine if the recommendation is based on solid research, right? And the word solid here is key, because if it's not solid, if it's based on, for example, like a personal or a non-science-based testimonial, that can be concerning, right? Because that's not science. And even if it is based on research, people should be cautious if those recommendations are based on like just one single study or research, you know, where they're stating like research is currently underway, which really indicates that there's no current completed research, right? Any sort of worthy nutrition recommendation should be based on robust and repeated research. And then, you know, I just want to say kind of related that to that, despite some of this guidance, people may find it kind of hard nonetheless, despite these recommendations, right, to kind of wade through and navigate all that information. And in those cases, I recommend they meet with a registered dietitian who can help talk through some of the issues or concerns that they have related to any nutrition issue.
Well, that's all the time that we have for now. Jessica, thanks so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Jessica Clifford, registered dietitian and nutrition specialist at the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Colorado State University, based in Fort Collins. And we want to hear from you. Is there a piece of health information that you've seen recently that makes you skeptical about its accuracy? You can email us or send a voice memo to scifry@sciencefriday.com. You can also leave us a voicemail at 646-767-6532. Or you can go to sciencefriday.com/health info to submit a topic. In the coming weeks, we'll bring on another expert to help answer your questions. We have to take a break, and when we come back, the science of the humble potato.
If you have tubers that maybe receive some kind of stress in the middle of the growing season, you might have that plant stop growing or grow very slowly. And once it can start growing at its full rate again, you might have a tuber that looks like a dumbbell.
What it takes to get your favorite side dish out of the dirt and onto your plate. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. For the rest of the hour, a bit of science for you to chew on at the Thanksgiving dinner table. We're talking about meat and potatoes. First, the humble potato, a versatile vegetable, baked, roasted, fried, mashed. What can't they do? But how exactly do these tasty tubers end up on our tables? Joining me now to give us a crash course in the science of potatoes is my guest, Dr. Rhett Speer, assistant professor in the plant sciences department at the University of Idaho, based in Aberdeen, Idaho. Dr. Speer, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I want to start with a little bit of potato 101. Can you tell us a little bit about how they grow?
Absolutely. So unlike a lot of plants that grow from an actual little seed that you plant in the ground, most potatoes are what they call vegetatively propagated. So what that means is if you take a potato and you cut it into pieces and throw it in the ground, that it will grow another plant. And that new plant will be genetically identical to the parent plant.
Okay, so let's back up here. So if I have like a pile of potato peels and other bits, is it possible that a potato would grow from that pile?
It depends on how big those bits are. If you have a decent sized piece, and it, as long as, you know, you look at the potato and you see those little divots on the outside of it that we call eyes, those eyes are actually where the stems grow from. So if you have a piece that's big enough and it has at least one eye on it, you can plant that piece. And as long as the conditions are right, you know, it's not too cold, it's not too wet, not too dry, that little piece will grow into a new potato plant.
Okay, so I think most people are familiar with maybe two distinctly different potatoes that they might come across in the grocery store. We've got the white potatoes and we've got sweet potatoes. What is the difference between the two?
So if you go back far enough into their family tree, so to speak, they are very, very distantly related, but more importantly, sweet potatoes are more part of the morning glory family, and potatoes are in the solanaceum family. So they're potatoes are in the same family as like tomatoes and tobacco and eggplants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go back to our good old white potatoes. How did we arrive at the common potato varieties that we see in the grocery store? So I'm thinking russets, Yukon Golds, red skin potatoes. How did we kind of come to this conclusion of these are the ones that we're going to find at basically every grocery store?
So a lot of that comes down to, you know, there's been something in their development that has been beneficial to the farmer or to the consumer. So a lot of these white potatoes, a lot of them will store fairly well and for a long time. Potatoes like Yukon Gold, you know, they have a really good taste and they're visually appealing. But most of these potatoes, while they do have lots of good things that have got them into the grocery store, oftentimes they'll have, I don't know if you want to call them speed bumps in their growth that could be a bigger hindrance, but the farmers know how to grow them. They've been growing them for long enough that they know how much fertilizer they need, how much water they need, when to plant and harvest them, and what they need in the season.
You have, I think, one of the coolest jobs out there. You help to develop new potato varieties. So as an expert in this, what makes for a good new potato?
So we're always looking for things like efficiency and sustainability. We want to see potato varieties that will turn a better profit for growers. So an example of this would be, we're looking for maybe potato varieties that use less fertilizer or are less impacted by stresses like heat or water.
Mm-hmm.
Things that will, you know, make that variety easier to grow or better to grow, or something that will help the industry to be better.
Mm-hmm. And I suspect that you also want those potatoes to taste good, right?
Oh, of course.
So what are the factors that actually contribute to the flavor of a potato?
So there's a lot of things that will actually contribute to the flavor. Anything from the soil that it's grown in to the different chemicals and volatiles and things that are actually in the potato that vary by variety. So if you eat a russet potato, it's probably going to taste different than if you eat a Yukon Gold or a red or a purple potato.
So we talked a little bit about the people who are actually growing these potatoes. How does weather affect the growing process for potatoes?
So weather is a huge factor when it comes to growing potatoes. The plant, based on the weather, can kind of start growing and stop growing. I don't know if that makes sense, but if it gets too cold, the plant kind of just, it doesn't grow as fast. And if you have potato tubers that are already growing at that point, you know, they stop receiving nutrients also. So when the potato starts growing again, and especially if it starts growing really fast, you could have one end of the tuber that's a lot smaller than the rest of the tuber. And if you have tubers that maybe receive some kind of stress in the middle of the growing season, like it got too hot or mm-hmm. the farmer didn't get the water on or something like that, you might have that plant stop growing or grow very slowly. And once it can start growing at its full rate again, you might have a tuber that looks like a dumbbell.
Okay. I don't know if I've ever seen a dumbbell-shaped potato, I have to say.
Well, quite often they'll cull those out. They'll pull them before they get to the store because they're not visually appealing. Nobody wants to buy that kind of potato.
We talk about climate change a lot on this show because it tends to affect everything. Does climate change play a factor into how you are thinking about developing new varieties of potatoes, into how these potatoes might grow?
Absolutely. So we really want to find varieties that are less susceptible to like heat stress or water stress, that they kind of like they can handle it a little bit better than some of the varieties that we currently use. So we do trials at the university where we'll stress these varieties on purpose. Like we won't give them enough water, or we'll give them not enough fertilizer, and we'll see at the end of the season how that affects the yield and the quality of those potatoes.
Mm-hmm. So let's shift gears here back to nutrition for a minute. Potatoes get a bad rap, I would say, for being unhealthy, but can you set the record straight for us? Are potatoes nutritious?
Absolutely, they're nutritious. Potatoes actually have quite a bit of a lot of the nutrients we need, like potassium and vitamin C and protein. So, you know, I used to know some guys that did long distance bike rides, and they would actually cook potatoes, little potatoes, and just put them in a bag on their back. And as they were riding these long distance rides, they would eat potatoes because it gave them a lot of the nutrients they needed for those big expenditures of energy.
What an amazing idea. I've never thought about that.
I think a lot of the bad rap comes from how the potatoes are prepared. Because, I mean, you don't go to Thanksgiving dinner with just a potato and no butter or no sour cream or no bacon. Or
Right.
You don't eat French fries that are not cooked in oil.
I have seen blue potatoes in the store, kind of a shocking sight. Are blue potatoes different nutritionally from white potatoes?
Yes. So there's been some research done that's looked at the nutrition of colorful potatoes like that compared to a white potato. And they do have higher concentrations of nutrients, of carotenoids, and other things that our bodies need. And so colored potatoes really do have a little bit more nutrients in them than just a regular white potato.
Mm. Okay. So as the potato expert, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite type of potato?
You know, I really do like specialty potatoes or these colorful potatoes. Our program released one called Huckleberry Gold, and it actually has a purple skin and a yellow flesh. Huh. And it is just excellent for making mashed potatoes.
That sounds beautiful. Do you have a least favorite type of potato that we should be avoiding?
Well, given my employment, I don't know if I should be bad-mouthing the potatoes that I don't like so much, but there are some that I wish that we could replace because they're not efficient to grow. They take a lot of nutrients and water, and any little tiny hiccup will, you know, give you a bad yield or bad quality in the end of the season.
Okay, so one little safety question to end us off here. Let's just say that I forgot about a potato in my pantry and it has turned green. Is it safe for me to eat that green potato?
You know, that green usually doesn't go very deep into the potato. So if you peeled it past the green, you'd probably be just fine. The potato plant does produce a toxic chemical called solanine that's usually pretty much concentrated in the leaves and the stems or the parts that we don't eat. But potatoes that have been left in the light can develop higher concentrations of that chemical. So I wouldn't recommend eating a green potato. I would probably peel that off first, but you'd probably have to eat a lot of them to get sick.
Good to know. And thank you so much for being here, Dr. Spear.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Dr. Rhett Spear, assistant professor in the plant sciences department at the University of Idaho, based in Aberdeen, Idaho. If you've been or been with a vegan or a vegetarian at a Thanksgiving meal, it's possible that you've run into the famous tofurkey roast, a round plant-based imitation meat. You can find plant-based meats in a lot of different forms these days, like sausages, deli meats, and faux chicken nuggets. But there are still a lot of challenges to getting plant-based meat to mimic their real counterparts. A big challenge for food scientists is marbling, which helps give real meat its, well, meaty texture. My guest today is working on this very question, Dr. David Julian McClements, Distinguished Professor in Food Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Welcome to Science Friday. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
So what is marbling in meat scientifically?
Yeah, so marbling is when you look at meat, you see these white regions and red regions, and the whitish regions are the regions full of fat, which is called adipose tissue. So you have these fat cells that have a whitish appearance because they scatter light quite strongly. And then they're surrounded by these red regions, which are the sort of fibrous, protein-rich regions.
So for anybody who has had plant-based meat, they'll know that it can be a monotextural experience. You don't have those pockets of fat and those other irregularities because the fake meat is processed to be that way. So how are you and your team looking at adding marbling to plant-based meat?
Yeah, we have a few different ways that we're trying to do it. One way is we use 3D printing. So we like create these edible inks. So we have like an edible ink, which is a plant-based adipose tissue. And then we have another edible ink, which is like the lean tissue, which has got a natural red color, like an extract from beet in it. And then we'll use a 3D printer to print like the fat-rich regions and the protein-rich regions, so it looks something like real meat.
So are you 3D printing just those elements, or can you 3D print like a plant-based steak in its entirety?
Yeah, I mean, I think my goal was always to do a plant-based bacon, because I'm a vegetarian now and I haven't eaten English bacon for years and years, and it was one of the things I really missed. So I've been trying to get my students to do like a nice plant-based bacon kind of product. But you could also do like a roast beef or something like that as well, or, you know, a turkey kind of product for Thanksgiving.
Right. What are the biggest challenges with marbling and adding this texture to plant-based meat?
Yeah, because I think if you look at real meat at the structural level, it's incredibly complicated. I think we're so used to these materials every day, we don't realize what's actually going on at the molecular level and the structural level. So I think trying to mimic the structural architecture of meat, these little tiny micrometer-sized fat cells, which are coated by phospholipids and proteins. So trying to mimic that with plant-based ingredients and get the same sort of texture and taste and appearance and nutritional properties is really, really challenging.
What have been the most successful strategies that you have found in your career?
Yeah, we use something called emulsion gels. They've got fat droplets in them, these very small little beads, which are full of fat, and we coat them with sort of proteins. And then inside them, we might put things like coconut oil, which will give like the solidity that you would normally get from the sort of lard you would get in beef or other kinds of products. So we can make a product that looks and feels a lot like real adipose tissue. But the problem with using coconut oil is it's full of saturated fat. And saturated fat is not good for your health, especially like heart health.
Right.
So we're trying to find alternatives for doing that to make it healthier as well.
I would imagine another challenge is, you know, when you're turning a raw steak into a cooked steak, when you cook that item, there's different chemistry going on with that fat compared to the other parts of the meat. Is that something that you have been working on addressing for plant-based meat?
Yeah, so if you look at real beef at room temperature, it's quite hard. But then when you heat it, all the fat crystals will melt and it'll become softer. And that sort of melting in your mouth characteristic can be really important for certain types of food products. So we're trying to mimic that behavior where it behaves in one way at room temperature. When you heat it, it behaves very differently. So it releases the oil and then that lubricates your mouth and gives you a nice sort of juicy mouthfeel when you're consuming the product.
How close do you think we are to having an effectively marbled piece of plant-based meat available for purchase?
We're getting closer. I don't think we're nowhere near there yet. And I think we still need to do a lot of science before we get there. But I think we're getting better and better at doing it. And there are some reasonably good products on the market now.
So not next year's Thanksgiving, but maybe a decade from now?
possibly a little bit shorter than that.
Besides marbling, what other textural challenges to plant-based meat are you working on?
Yeah, I think, you know, the marbling's to do with the fat part of the meat, but it's also the challenges to do with the lean part of the meat. And the lean part of the meat is what gives it its like chewiness in the mouth. And I think if you've eaten a lot of these plant-based products, you know, like Impossible Burger or Beyond Meat Burger, they often are quite mushy when you bite into them. So they break down too easily in your mouth. So we're trying to make a product that would be more simulating like a real meat product and how that behaves so it retains some of its texture in the mouth when you're chewing it. And again, that's really challenging to do because plant-based ingredients are very, very different from animal-based ingredients. So you need to use all these structural architecture methods to try and do that.
I have heard this argument a lot in my own time exploring meat alternatives, where people say, why are you going for these ultra-processed fake meats when you can just eat lentils or beans or get your protein elsewhere? And I'm sure you've heard that a lot as well. So as a food scientist, why focus on making plant-based meats better?
Yeah, I think the ultimate objective is to address sort of greenhouse gas emissions and sustainability and biodiversity. So I think, you know, the meat and livestock production is a really big contributor to all those adverse effects on our environment. So we want to create this new generation of foods that are going to be better for our environment and also better for our health. But if you look at consumers, like 95% of consumers are meat eaters. So we really need to target the meat eaters if we want to have a big environmental and sustainability impact. So we need to make a product that people don't need to make any lifestyle changes. They can just go to the supermarket, buy a product, it looks the same, it tastes the same, it cooks the same. So you don't have to make any changes, but you're having a big impact on the environment.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. David Julian McClements, Distinguished Professor in Food Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thanks so much for being here.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. If you missed any part of the program or you want to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. We'll see you next week. I'm Kathleen Davis.